With us, our political commentators, it's Neil Jones and Bridget Morton. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Neil was Chief of Staff to the then Labor leader Jacinda Ardern, before that Chief of Staff to the then Labor leader Andrew Little. He's Director of Public Affairs firm Capital. Bridget's a Director in Public and Commercial Law firm Franks Ogilvie, a former Senior Ministerial Advisor to the previous National-led government, a member of the National Party who volunteers for its deputy leader during election campaigns. You are listening to Nine to Noon. Deputy leader, of course, is now the finance minister. Right, the 100 days deadline, it's become a thing. It is a thing. There's nothing constitutional about it. It is simply a means of looking like you're doing things in the first 100 days and wanting to sort of tick the box on the promises you've made. So there's been a rush to get there for National, but it's got a fair bit through now. Bridget, is this a successful marker in time?
I think it is a marketing ploy. It's got nothing, as we say, constitutional about it. But I think it's been particularly effective for National because it's really contrasted against the previous government, which they ran really strongly against that non-delivery aspect. And so for them, they're able to demonstrate about getting a lot of stuff done in a very short amount of time. A lot of really popular stuff done as well. You know, 90-day trials, fair pay, all that sort of stuff is gone, which, you know, really helping out their business audience. I think they also, I mean, weird number, but 49 action points. I don't quite understand where they landed with 49.
Okay, you really are into Geeksville now.
But
whatever the 50th?
Well, that's a good question. But I think in terms of those action points, the vast majority of them were actual sort of completed action points. They weren't just start, review, inquire, which is quite interesting in terms of actually how much they've had to get done. Hence why they've had to use urgency through Parliament quite considerably.
I think the 100-day plans are a useful device. I mean, yes, they are very much a marketing tool, but that's about showing that your government's hitting the ground running, it has an action plan. I think it's also quite useful to focus the minds of ministers in those early days about getting things done and also the public service. But I think the real benefit of them is showing what your priorities are to the electorate. And I was involved in Labor's sort of setting up Labor's 100-day plan, and that had things like, you know, the families package coming in, things like first year free, things like restarting superannuation funds, stopping the state health sell-off, sort of very core Labor things. What we've seen from National, there are a lot of things, they've completed them all, but most of them are, to be fair, repeal or cancel. There's a lot of sort of work left undone, which is what are you going to replace it with? So I think that's a challenge. I also think it's been, some of the choices have been odd, things they've focused on the first 100 days, which have come from the coalition agreements. And so I think a lot of that has been, you know, caught up in culture wars, smoking, treaty. I think that's been, in terms of showing what your priorities are, I'm not sure that's necessarily the priorities that I've wanted to show.
Which is interesting. We might talk about the Courier poll shortly and to whether that point is very relevant to that. You mentioned had to do urgency. Well, they only had to do urgency because they gave themselves this deadline. I don't know if you heard my colleague, Corin Dan. I'm worried for the hair on his head, frankly. He was feeling like he was going to be ripping shreds out of it this morning. Tired of hearing, and, you know, all parties have their talking points, all governments have their talking points. It's called spin. But, you know, we were elected too. Well, first point, you were 30-something percent elected as a party to do something. And second point, we still have a parliament and a democracy, and the election is the starting point for it. The parliament is the scrutineer. It helps prevent you make terrible law. Are we going to get sick of that, or is it just the Beltway that's going to get sick of hearing, and Corin, who's going to get sick of hearing that excuse?
Yeah, I don't think most people out in the wide populace care that much about the use of urgency. They would rather see the things that they are concerned about slowing them down, and so, you know, like fair pay or 90-day trials as those types of things that people are like, great, this is off the books, I don't have to worry about it. They'd like to see action on things like tough on crime, so going to Neil's point about what your priorities are. We know this was a big issue during the election was crime. They've made some really big you know, law changes there. I think also, whilst I'm very big as a complete nutter nerd on the importance of scrutiny, I do think whether or not it's actually a waste of time using select committee when you're going to repeal things. So if you're repealing things straight out, do you really need to scrutinise that bill? And you contrast that, and I know we're going to talk about it in a bit, the fast track legislation. They're going through a full 6 month process on that. That is something in which they could say that they are replacing or, you know, fixing, and that is going through the full scrutiny. So if that, I think, had gone through under urgency, I would have concerns, but I'm less concerned about getting that repeal agenda.
What about the smoke-free legislation? Then we could have tested some of these claims about what has brought down smoking rates, and over time, whether it was taxes or whether actually now that it's getting down to marginal gains, the vaping has made the difference, right? That's something where you could have had actual facts on the table if you'd had a process.
Yes, but you've got to remember, in terms of the smoking, they're repealing the last lot of law changes that Labor brought in, and those changes are the ones that actually haven't really been tested. They haven't actually, in terms of the implementation, they haven't actually come in. So I don't think that was actually led to an evidence-based debate.
All right, let's get into some of what has happened of late. Let's start with the fast-track legislation. This is the other criticism you could have, arguably from a democracy perspective, over the speed of law changes here, is that it's obscuring how far-reaching some of this is. What's your take on the fast-track legislation now being proposed? How does it differ from what the Labor government used during COVID?
The key difference is that it puts the final decision and the decision to allow it in the hands of ministers rather than an expert panel. And I think, you know, this is one of those things that, if done judiciously, could be very popular and effective. I think you talk to anyone who's been involved in trying to consent things in New Zealand, it's very hard to get anything done. We have a huge infrastructure crisis. Part of that's funding, but part of that's actually getting things through that process. My concern, though, is that I'm not sure this government will be judicious with it. And I suspect what will happen is, in a few years' time, there'll be a crescendo of community pushback on projects. There will be probably allegations of conflicts of interest and so forth. And that will lead to it coming to a halt. So I suspect it will probably die a death at some point in the coming years. But look, I do think that we do have a problem with consent in New Zealand, and in principle, the idea of unlocking that is not the worst thing.
Yeah, and first, just a declaration, I've got clients that want to be part of this process. So,
and I may well at some point as well.
Yeah, so I think, looking at this bill, absolutely, this is what we have to do. I think we can't wait around for another RMA replacement. It does create a difficult position for Labor, and I saw them trying to go quite hard, particularly sort of on Twitter and things over the weekend, about sort of pointing out about how fast this is happening. But ultimately, we go back to non-delivery as the key, you know, sort of legacy of the last government, and they spent millions and millions of dollars and hours on a very inadequate RMA replacement that would have actually slowed down things like wind farms. So I think that this will be really popular because people will see that things are actually happening. But to Neil's point, we know that people have really strong reactions to things happening in their backyards. NIMBYism is well and truly alive. So if people have those strong reactions, they will vote on those. So when you saw Chris Bishop yesterday on, I think it was on Q&A, talking about accountability in 3 years, I think that's going to be the really hard accountability on this, because it's so obvious when there's an infrastructure project in your backyard.
A couple of controversies, though, just to help me. Doesn't this new legislation cut out things like iwi consultation that used to be in the old system? Is that incorrect, Bridget? Because I saw it being discussed.
No. So
that's what Ngāi Tahu was concerned about.
So they have the ability to cut me into the process, not in the same way that they currently do, because this is one of the things that's slowing down, is the wide consultation. So there's opportunities for consultation for iwi partners as well as non-iwi people that are affected directly. There's also, when you look at the expert panel, who's the one that's setting the conditions, they also have to look at lots of these aspects.
Of course, the expert panel, though, doesn't get the final say, the minister does. And there's always, always going to be a political vulnerability around that.
Yes, and that's why often, when it comes to sort of quasi-judicial decisions, ministers try to stay out of that and defer those to other bodies, because they don't want to be politically accountable. They want to be able to say, look, that decision's one for an independent decision. I think, you know, Chris Bishop is right in a sense that this is a democratic move, and that it is it's bringing it right into the political realm, and ministers will be accountable at the election.
Yeah, that's like
in
saying the Reserve Bank. You know, we could make it political accountability by having the finance minister set interest rates.
You could.
You know, there are reasons why we have this separation.
And right? I'm just saying, like, my point is, by taking on that responsibility, he makes it an election issue, the decisions that he's made, in a way that if it was made independently, you can point to those, you can point to that process.
Final point, I think it was Claire Trevett on Friday morning on the Morning Report panel who said there's a report back mechanism where a minister can go back to the panel if it thinks provisions are too stringent. There's no such thing if the minister thinks they're not stringent enough. There does seem to be an inherent bias towards do it unless there's a really, really overwhelming...
I think most people probably agree that right now the pendulum has swung too far against getting things done. I suspect this is pushing it too far the other way. and that's where I think they're going to come a cropper in a few years.
The transport plan was an interesting one also, in that, we could argue the toss about whether a tax in 2027 is a new tax for a government when it campaigned last time. We could go on like that, but there's no doubt there is a plan there. There are going to be greater costs towards road users to help fund that plan. Interestingly, though, the latest thing I'm reading is the Transport Minister admitting 8 roads of national significance may not be underway this term. They're about to hit reality on that front too, Bridget.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there was some commentary I saw over the weekend about sort of dividing that up in terms of what was going to be this term and what was going to be sort of the next term. And I think that was actually pretty clear from National's pre-election material. Possibly not, you know, what they put front and centre. So most people just heard Great Petone to Granada Link, for instance. So I think obviously that's going to be an issue for some people. But ultimately it comes down to, as you say, the money and also this consenting aspect. So I think you'll probably see what the priorities are for those roads will probably come through in that fast-tracking ledge.
I think what we also saw is that there is no free lunch. So National ran an election campaign campaigning against fuel taxes going up, sort of against any hard decisions. And what we're seeing
now... Cancel the Auckland regional fuel tax.
Yeah. And what we're seeing now is they're still going to do that 12 cents. They're just delayed it a bit, but they're bringing in $50 on your rego. And we're also seeing that these roads aren't all funded properly. So we're talking about PPPs. PPPs can have a role in transport, though when it comes to building roads, I'm not sure what value they're bringing.
And actually, both Puhoi and Transmission Gully, they throw
blowouts.
Up very specific issues pertaining to that model.
Yeah, massive blowouts, right?
Yeah, and massive blowouts and an argument over who pays, and it certainly wasn't the private sector.
And so, this is the thing, is often with PPPs, it's sort of treated as if it's free money. The private sector will just build this for us. Actually, it's like rent to own, and you end up paying more in the end than you would have if you just borrowed it and done it yourself.
What do you make of how the opposition, just pick with these two, there's plenty else that we won't get time to talk to, the school lunches move, which may or may not happen, but which David Seymour is certainly planting his name over with this review. There's kind of been plenty there for the opposition parties to begin to find their voice. But have they on some of these big things?
Well, I think there's a difference between having your voice and having it actually listened to. And that's a problem always the oppositions have straight after an election. They're just swamped. People are not concentrating on what the opposition is doing because, frankly, they can't really do anything.
You're still going to try.
Yeah, and I do think there definitely was a slow start, I would say, from Labor. But I think in the last couple of weeks, you've definitely seen some of the Labor MPs, and particularly ones, you know, I think go back to that fast-tracking bill. Rachel Brooking was very, very sort of vocal about it. Barbara Edmonds has obviously stepped up. So there's no doubt that you're starting to hear from them more. I do have some sympathy for them, though, that you don't really get that much chance to have a voice.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Bridget's saying there. I had an example the other day where a friend of mine said, where's Chris Hipkins on this issue? He should be saying X, Y, and Z. And I was like, well, he actually is in the article. He's just on paragraph 14. And so no one reads that far. And so the challenge is often just being heard because you're not the centre of the story. You're the government that's just been kicked out. And there's a cyclical thing to it. I do think Labor does need to pick its battles a bit. I'm not sure they've got it right on the fast track thing. I think, like Bridget says, there is a risk the way they're framing it and how they're choosing to tackle it, that they look like they're anti-development and getting things done, which is a problem Labor's going to have to overcome from the perceptions from the last term around delivery. And the other one I thought recently was odd was quite noisy about the gang patch ban, which, again, I just wonder, why is Labor talking about gangs? National loves talking about gangs. Perhaps focus more on things like giving landlords tax cuts. Focus on things like the free school lunches. And don't focus on things that potentially trigger negative perceptions about Labor.
What did we learn from the Courier poll with the usual disclaimer? It's a strange part of the season and strange season in the term, and it is one poll. This one, however, did have a couple of interesting points to it. Just help me. National down a little bit. Labor sort of static down a little bit, if anything, in terms of the actual headline numbers.
Yeah, National was down one seat. Labor was down 2 seats.
All right. And the interesting thing, though, was the right track, wrong track, and also the preferred Prime Minister.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you look at the straight party vote, the current government has a very healthy majority, and that's been pretty consistent. What was interesting was we are now no longer back on track, we're now back off track, so the right track, wrong track is negative for the government, so more New Zealanders think that the country's going the wrong direction than the right direction, and the government confidence rating is down at -4, so more people think the government's doing a bad job than a good job. And Christopher Luxon down 16 points in the favourability.
That's a slamming, but this poll coincided with the controversy over
It came in the days following the Premier House debacle.
So he got a slapping for that.
That might be amplified there. And the question for him will be, does that go away or does it become defining? But he's now negative favourability, so more people have an unfavourable view of him than favourable. So, again, next to a pretty anemic sort of preferred PM result in other polls, we're seeing, you know, quite a mix in the background of a leader who's a prime minister who's not that popular and a government that is not being seen to do that well. And I think what we're seeing is people aren't in this point of the cycle ready to go back to Labour. But I do think the government has a vulnerability there.
Not much of a honeymoon then.
No, there hasn't been much of a honeymoon, and I think in part that's because they really started the government really close up to Christmas and then have really had to... That 100 days has mostly been taken up by the Christmas holidays and they've had to come back early. So I think that's just going to be the case. But I think, you know, rightly, you know, before we sort of came on here, we were talking about that right track, wrong track probably has a lot to do with the economic situation. You know, most people's interest rates are still high with not much hope on the horizon. You know, inflation is still really high. We're talking about lots of cuts. You can particularly feel that in Wellington in terms of, you know, the public service feeling that austerity. And so I think that is really key, that we can't overestimate just actually how squeezed the government really is in terms of getting stuff done.
It was a hip pocket election, and the hip pockets are feeling tighter than they were before the election.
Yeah, absolutely.
Look, I think the hip pocket is probably a meta that sits across it, no doubt. But, I mean, the government has been doing a lot of things that, if you poll on things like their policy on smoking, around what they've been doing on the treaty, I think if you looked at a lot of these issues, they're probably not that popular as issues. And it's been kind of surprising.
Is this really going to change your...
necessarily changing their vote, but I would understand if a lot of people are kind of looking at it and going, I'm not quite sure this is going that well.
The thing is, when you're looking at interest rates as high as they are, when you're looking at cost of living as high as it is, when you are looking at the number of defaults on mortgages and loans, there's no question that many people, for them, the right track, wrong track is directly related to where they are. But to the point that many others have made, Bridget, this should be no surprise to the government, you know, that we had this big melodrama before Christmas about all the skeletons in the cupboard, but they were the ones who were saying how bad the economy was. And guess what? When your economy's bad, your tax income shrinks. It shouldn't be a huge surprise.
Yeah, I don't think it's a surprise, but ultimately when you take a big corporate tax hit like they did last week, I think, in the crowd accounts, that was not what was forecast, so that was a big hit, which when you're in, you know, budget hunting season, which they are at the moment, you've got to find those dollars somewhere else. So I don't think it's a surprise, but it's the toughness of it. And regardless of how prepared you are for government, and I think this goes for all parties, getting in and actually unpicking those books and the things that are going to stop, like school lunches that you've got to find money for if you want to support them, it's really, really hard. And you don't... Opposition, that's actually a nice place to be sometimes because you don't actually have to make the numbers add up.
But I mean, I just would push back against this deterministic view that it's just the economy. I mean, John Key came in at the height of the global financial crisis. And sure, people would have said the economy was doing badly, but they thought the government was doing a pretty good job and they thought he was doing a good job. And I think you can't...
What were interest rates and what was inflation like, though? That's the...
I can't remember the top of my
head.
That's
the killer at the moment.
But my point is...
I'm not
denying that. And just as with the election result, I would say part of that was because of the economy and part of that was Labour's political decisions. And I think the same goes here. I think you can't be giving billions to landlords, crying poverty and talking about taking food out of the mouths of school children and say, oh, we've got no money because of the economy and, oh, it's all just because people are unhappy with interest rates. The government is making choices. They're making political decisions. And I think people are judging them on it.
I would say that we were completely correct about 2 or 3 weeks ago, Bridget, when we said they would can the retrospective move with landlords and they're going to start from April 1st. That's an easy way to put a few more bob in your budget for this year, but confirming they're going to stick with the plan beyond that. Okay, the Greens co-leader is Chloe Swarbrick. No great surprise there. She made an interesting remark in a comment in an article I read. Must have been yesterday. Along the lines of Greens could be more mainstream or can do mainstream politics, which is an interesting thing to come from someone perceived as being an activist in the party. We know there's that constant friction between its activist base and trying to sort of get the, you know, the worried, well, green voters in leafy suburbs. What did you make of that? Was it just a line picked out of an interview or was she trying to position right at the start?
Look, it's almost a direct comparison with David Seymour, which is probably not what she wants. But you remember when National was also down in the polls?
I'm just showing you the headline. The Greens can go mainstream, says Albrecht.
Yeah, and, you know, when National was polling about this, the same as where Labour is at the moment, you know, ACT, you know, went up in the polls quite considerably. They were talking, you know, that they were possibly going to be the biggest opposition party. It's very, very similar. And I do think that there is the possibilities for the Greens to go mainstream. We are, even though it wasn't as big an issue, we still know an issue for a lot of New Zealand is the environment and climate change. The question is, I can't see in that leadership team, or even particularly across the MPs that they've currently got in their caucus, about who is going to play that James Shaw conciliatory role that actually gets it mainstream. Because it's all well and good to talk about climate change being a problem, but you have to have solutions that are palatable to households. Yeah, with interest rate bills that are really high, with cost of living really high, that don't want to see additional costs on their cars to get to work.
Yeah, look, I think Chloe Swarbrick is a, you know, she is a politician who has a real X factor about her, that rare quality that very few leaders have, but, and I think she'll do a good job. And I'd be very cautious to underestimate her after I said on the show in 2020 that she had no hope of winning Auckland Central, and she proved me wrong. So I'm sure she'll do a good job for them, and I think this is an opportunity for the Greens to grow their vote at Labour's expense. You know, we're new, and, you know, parties are left in new in opposition. There'll be people who are grumpy about the current government, and they're looking for a place to go. So there is that. I think the challenge about the Greens becoming sort of the major party on the left is to try and bridge, you know, this morning she talked about both coming from sort of an activist campaigning radical perspective and also winning mainstream. That's quite a gap to bridge. And, you know, people on the Greens are often quite critical of Labour for not going as hard and as fast as they could or they should or they would. But often that's because voters, you know, the median voter has got some real concerns. They find change hard, there are real barriers in the way, and it's not easy to persuade those people to vote for progress. And so if for Chloe to both please the activist wing of the Green Party and the median voter will be a real challenge, I think.
Well, the challenge for the left at the moment is how split those votes are. And this is always what happens when you see a major party fall into the 20s. It happened with National in the early 2020s, and then you see the third parties rise. But it's not only the Greens who've got a fair chunk of votes, primarily probably from Labour's flank, but Te Pāti Māori's party vote has consistently been knocking on the door of 5% since this election. So you've got three parties of the left, all with their own kind of particular focus and their own kaupapa. And the question is, how is that going to coalesce in time if they're going to, you know, I mean, to your point earlier, will the left be able to stage a comeback by the end of these 3 years, or is it in for a 6 or 9 year hiatus? That will be a very interesting question. But that vote is so split at the moment on the left.
We don't know. And I think what we're seeing in New Zealand is a polarisation like we're seeing around the world. We're on the right, we're seeing it. We're seeing a lot of National's traditional vote has gone to New Zealand First and ACT for people who are far further on the right than National is. Similarly, Labour is seeing that on its left. A lot of people who would have previously been Labour voters are now going for, you know, eco-socialism or Māori nationalism.
Or big radical tax changes that Labour wasn't prepared to make.
Yeah, so those, both Labour and National, are being pulled by the fringes of their own side. And I say fringe not derogatory in a sense, but just in the sense that those
of
on the
numbers.
Outside. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that's a challenge that Labour faces just as National does. And I'm sure Labour can pull together, you know, with the Greens, possibly with Te Pāti Māori, a coherent enough alternative by 2026. The challenge they'll have, though, is do the public buy that? And I think it's the same challenge National has. I mean, what we're seeing now with the government and all the weird and wonderful things they're doing, all the oddities, that relates to National having to do compromises with quite large parties to its right.
That said, if it gets those compromises done now, it has time. And one of the flaws in Labour's approach to its two terms in government was being so slow in its first term before COVID hit, right? It had 3 years, and it was working group, working group, working group. And then it had the crisis of the second term, right? And so many people will say, front-load your big changes, bed them in, so that they're not left too late in the term. So these oddities, as you call them, are being progressed quickly as part of the coalition.
But I do think, you know, Labour and the Greens need to figure out how they're going to work together this term, because if they spend the term fighting, that's not going to help anyone. I think they need to find, you know, the the story of Labor.
Wants to supplant the other.
Well, yeah, and that could be a challenge. But I'm sure they'll find eventually within the 3 years they'll find a detente and they'll find a way to make it work.
All right, thanks both of you very, very much for that, Neil Jones and Bridget Morton.